Representative Larson, Representative Liska, Representative Ewing, and Representative Ringstad. Got three bills for us today. The first one is 376, dealing with limited entries, the one we were working on yesterday that we cut short there in the middle. I want to kind of bring that up, complete that, and get it passed out if we could. Sharman is here with us again today, so we can answer questions if we need to. We have a kind of a revised copy of the amendment she was proposing yesterday, which has one little change in it. You should be a copy of that in your packet. Section 1, paragraph C there, said yesterday's was stated the commissioner. Now it says the commercial entries fishery. Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission may establish the regulations, which is the more technical verbiage on that. I think we got through all of the bill yesterday, so now it's just if we want to go back for discussion and work on this, we can get the bill adopted and get it moved along. Representative Schultz?
Mr. Chairman, if it's appropriate to do so right now, I would like to make a motion that we include the amendments as outlined on the revision of 52483 into House Bill number 376. Is that appropriate this time to do that?
Yes, sir.
If so, I move that we adopt the amendments to House Bill 376 be included in House Bill 376 and ask unanimous consent.
Any objections to that?
Objection. I would like to have the lady who was talking on this explain this. Is this section one in detail what we've got here?
Section one of the amendments you're asking about?
Yes.
This would create the general statutory authority to establish landing permits. Landing permits under this section would allow the Department of Fish and Game to issue permits to federally licensed fishermen who fish exclusively in the Federal Fisheries Conservation Zone to land their catch in the state of Alaska. Currently under Alaska state law, that's illegal.
So what they're doing, if they're catching them out beyond the 3 mile limit, that allows them to bring them into an Alaskan process.
Right.
As opposed to having to take them to Seattle or wherever else in the world they might.
I thought we'd addressed that yesterday on a different section of this. Still back under section one, is that right?
Section one of the amendment. Same one we had yesterday on that.
Yeah, all right.
You maintain the objection or?
No.
Okay. Hearing no other objections, we'll adopt that into the into a committee substitute. Going through the different sections in the bill, there was questions yesterday in a couple of different sections. Starting at the top, section one, the adopting regulations for the tie-breaking votes within the commissioners. Any ideas or comments on that? My assumption is that this will just as be a temporary measure for most cases, won't it, Sharman?
Yes.
Representative Ewing?
Yeah, I don't see the purpose in even why should we allow them to adopt the regulations in the first place? Isn't there a way of having decisions made by, let's say, a majority vote of some sort, or perhaps you can answer
if
that?
If one commissioner is unavailable, then there are only two commissioners voting, and if they can't agree, there won't be a majority. And all that has not arisen in the past, it's not been a problem yet, but this is just looking ahead to a potential case in which it may arise.
I question what the regulations are going to be and by giving them that authority, I would really question even the need for the section at all. I just, if they haven't had past cases where it's really been a problem,
that was my question.
It's likely to be a little more of a problem with the current commissioners, simply because one of our present commissioners is formerly a legal services attorney and previously did some limited entry work. And some of the people who now are coming before the commission were clients that he had, and he excuses himself from those cases. In the past, none of our commissioners have had any conflicts and have not needed to excuse themselves. Now, that's not happening a lot, but the potential of that occurring is increased now. And we just, under the present law, don't know what we would do if that situation arose. Don't know what the appropriate solution would be.
Which commissioner is that?
Bruce Twomley. His name is up for confirmation.
Governor Schultz?
Well, to avoid those kinds of conflicts, maybe it would be advisable to change commissioners.
Representative Ewing?
Yeah, my point would be that if you're going to, it would seem that the intent behind this particular section would be to avoid the whole idea of setting up the commission in the first place, and that was to get, let's say, a majority vote that are going to take up particular issues or to take up regulations. And what you're doing here is you're allowing the commission to adopt regulations over and above the voting members on that commission. And from that standpoint, I would object to it. And I don't know if there's a better solution to it, but it would seem like I still don't see the argument for it. If you could bear with me, please.
Representative Larson?
Yeah, the only problem I would have is there's three commissioners, and one of them may have a conflict. A person bringing something to that commission starts out handicapped because he knows that there's only two commissioners that are even eligible to vote. And therefore, it's a handicap to the petitioner, not the commission itself. And I guess in that case, if it is possible to have a commissioner who does have conflicts because of his prior representation, maybe we do need some regulations.
Mr. Chairman, I really question why we need to have regulations to circumvent the whole idea of adopting a majority vote on a commission. That would be my final point. I don't see the necessity for that.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask the lady a question. How the commission expects to adopt regulations to break a tie? What do you have in mind? How are you going to adopt regulations for three people?
The two things that we had considered were when a particular case arises in which the two commissioners who were sitting on the case cannot come to an agreement, under one scenario, regulations would have been adopted providing that a retired former commissioner could be appointed to sit just on that one case, so that there would then be three commissioners and no possibility of a tie vote. Another possibility that had been considered was to let this tie stand as a stalemate and make the hearing officer's recommended decision the final decision of the commission. There are some drawbacks to having the hearing officer's commission stand, simply because the hearing officer is normally only makes recommended decisions and has not been officially delegated the authority to make final determinations on these kinds of issues.
Well, Mr. Chairman, should I ask her? What's the criteria for your commissioners? Are they commercial fishermen? Is that one of your criteria? Are they laymen, commercial fishermen, or?
The commissioners are appointed by the governor for four-year terms and appointed and confirmed by the legislature. No commissioner can hold any vested interest in a commercial fishery while he serves on the commission. Presently, none of the commissioners have ever been commercial fishermen, though they have all had some other kinds of background connected with fisheries.
What's the name of the new appointee that Governor sent for Bruce? What's his last name?
Bruce Twomley.
How do you spell that? Do you recall?
T-W-O-M-L-E-Y.
Twomley.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll make a motion. Are we going to take we've adopted the committee substitute for House Bill 376. Are we still going to take testimony, or do you want a motion?
Well, if you want to do it, just go through and work through the sections. There's two or three of these sections we had questions with yesterday, and I'd like to try and clear those up and discuss those a little bit.
Why don't we discuss those, and I'll go back and we can take each section.
Okay. The other section that brought up some question yesterday was Section 3, which is the subparagraph E, dealing with being able to correct administrative errors. One of the points that was made on this was that the original intent, I think, would be that an administrative error should be able to be corrected. So putting this in here at this point is something we should do, recognizing that that was the original intent of the legislation. We're just clarifying this in a retroactive type of manner, so if there are administrative errors that have been made, they can go back and correct them.
Mr. Chairman, what errors would that include? If you could give me some examples of some errors.
We've had an opinion from the Attorney General on what the scope of our powers under this proposed language would be, and he clarified that we would not be allowed to go back and change discretionary decisions by the Commission. For example, if a person came up with a claim that having to stay with a sick wife and not being able to fish should be granted points, and the Commission granted it, they couldn't go back 2 years later and change their minds and say staying with a sick wife is not sufficient grounds, and you know that was an error to have said that. They can't do that sort of thing. They cannot change discretionary decisions. What they can do is correct ministerial type errors where points were granted where there's absolutely no evidence to support that award, where the person really had no authority to verify those points and did it as a matter of error.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This AG's opinion, do you have that? Can we have that?
I can provide you with a copy, certainly. Mm-hmm. I don't have a copy with me.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see just what depth they go to allow you to the flexibility for your administrative procedures.
The other issue that the Attorney General's opinion mentioned was the one I mentioned yesterday, that the power to correct error couldn't go on indefinitely into the future after the fishermen had developed a substantial reliance on having this permit, that under law there's a theory of, you know, an equitable theory that says if a person has relied on having some sort of right and developed over a long period of time that reliance, you just can't go back and take it away because it was error to issue it to them. So we would propose to adopt some time limits on how far back we could go to correct administrative error. And what we had been talking about was 3 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps I could ask you this. Was that AG's opinion the current nominee for that position, or was it the previous AG?
It was an assistant attorney general.
Well, I understand that, but any assistant attorney general is the AG up there. Is it this year's, this group, this block?
It's a recent opinion.
Sounds like a good one. Yeah.
Further comments on Section 3? Okay, I think those were the only two sections yesterday that the questions were raised on. Any other questions with these? Representative Ewing, you wanted to...
Maybe Representative Bussell has further questions, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, for being late. But I did have questions on on Section 1. You know, I thought the legislature should do that and not allow, you know, further latitude for the department to just go out and adopt wholesale regulations that have the force of law. Obviously, the conversation that was reported to the committee yesterday was that they needed additional laws in that area, and they proposed to do it by regulation. And I don't think that's good public policy, nor do I think it's healthy for anybody to allow the department or the administration or anybody else that kind of latitude.
Representative Ewing's been working on that one in earlier discussions, early in the meeting, and we were discussing that one, and he was, I don't know, he was working out a motion. I'm not sure which way it's going to come out.
Well, are we finished with testimony, or
yeah,
would you want to, there may be some...
There's no one else here to testify on this. Yes, sir? Boy, you're the only one who likes this. Any other areas that we didn't, other than Section 1 and 3, that... If not, Representative Ewing, did you have a suggestion on Section 1?
My suggestion would be that, well, first of all, I'll make a motion, unless you want me to explain my rationale behind it.
Either way.
The line 11 through 13, I think, should be deleted. So I'll move and ask unanimous consent that starting at subsection B under Section 1, line 11 through line 13 be deleted, and ask for unanimous consent.
Which... an objection here for the point of clarification. Are we going to put something back in there?
Well, I imagine we could just delete it all the way up from 9.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Unless we're going to put in a new Section 1, we should delete the whole section.
Okay, then I'll move and ask unanimous consent that we delete Section 1 completely all the way down to the period at the end of line 13.
I'll object for purposes of a question, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Larson?
On the acting commissioner, what are the regulations under which a person can excuse himself from voting at this time on the commission? Does he just simply state, well, I believe I got a conflict and therefore I'm not going to vote?
We have not adopted any regulations governing that sort of matter. We tend to follow the Davis Manual on Administrative Law when questions of that nature come up. And my understanding is that any time that the commissioner, him or herself, believes that they cannot render an unbiased decision, they can voluntarily excuse themselves from the case. And that, in most cases, is what has happened.
Mr. Chairman, I guess if we're talking about regulations, maybe the regulations we need would be regulations that would state the conditions under which a person could ask to be excused. If a person finds that that becomes frequent, that they have a conflict, then maybe the person might find that maybe someone else should be on the commission.
My point exactly, Mr. Chairman.
Question also in regards to the motion. Sharon, how many cases this come up, do you recall, where this a tie vote is involved? Is it troublesome?
It has not happened to date. I mean, there has been no situation where a commissioner has excused himself and the remaining two commissioners are not in agreement.
Well, somebody must have a different crystal ball than I have. I mean, if you haven't had anything like that, now how come you're putting something like this in here where...
Simply because...
I mean, it's a very question with me. Why do we need something like this if it's never happened before?
Simply because sooner or later it is likely to happen, and when it does happen, that applicant is left in limbo. We have no idea what happens to their request for a fishing permit, and we'd like to resolve that question in fairness to the applicants.
Further questions or objections to the motion? Comments? Hearing none, we'll delete section one. Other comments or areas of the bill? Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 376 and ask for individual recommendations from this committee.
As
amended.
Committee substitute.
Committee substitute for House Bill number 376 as amended.
Yeah.
Ask for individual recommendations.
That would include the amendment we adopted earlier today and the addition and deleting section one, renumbering them, etc.
Right. Right. Objection one, amendments to the right.
Objections to that? Hearing none, we'll move out 376. Next,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bussell.
Before I sign the committee report, you're going to have this prepared into some kind of a readable committee substitute very quickly, right?
I
ask that you
hold
the committee
tomorrow.
Report till tomorrow until we could see this here, so we could kind of take a look at. I got some extensive notes on this, and I feel rather strongly about some of these provisions. Not that I distrust anybody, but it's kind of all messed up here, and I'd like to see it informed.
Okay, with no objection, we'll hold the committee report and have it for the committee tomorrow afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, no problem. The next one we want to bring up, HCR 37, should be a short one here. resolution relating to the economic development policy. So, is there anyone here to testify on HCR 37? There you go. I thought maybe he'll want to talk to us today.
For the record, my name is Dave Gray, and I'm representing Resource Development Council on HCR 37, and they strongly endorse this resolution. Maybe you know the Resource Development Association Council is an organization of people interested in Alaska growth and through development of resources and, of course, economical benefit. Is there any questions?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, what areas do you think we really have to work on as far as economic development, and how do you feel that this resolution is going to help improve the economic climate of Alaska?
I think that the Resource Development Council's position is that if you just set something down, and I think if you look through this resolution, it tries to cover everything, but at least it puts it in some one format, say this is the policy, then that should assist in having the working parts of government and private sector and federal for that matter to better at least form some kind of a thrust. I think that's basically what they see as the value in it. I don't think there's much that hasn't been discussed at one time in this part here or with this contract there, or this development possibility here, or this part there, you know. But to put some kind of a statement and then build from there.
Another question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you feel that this particular resolution kind of goes hand in hand with HB 14, which was to put the permitting of certain Department of Natural Resources permitting as far as oil and gas leasing? Do you think this sort of falls in line with trying to put it all under one agency so they can coordinate things with private enterprise to implement growth in Alaska?
Well, I think considerations, and I think the council would also agree on this, I think considerations such as HB 14 fall beneath this policy statement, whether it is a single agency. I think in that discussion, it's efficiency. Let's have the protection that the permitting thing is supposed to do, but let's not go overboard or stymie something. And so I think that considerations like HB 14 do fit underneath this policy statement.
Further questions, Mr. Gray? Hang on. Thank you, sir. Representative Schultz?
You ready for a motion at this point?
I have a question, maybe not to Mr. Gray, but just Mr. Chairman. On the page 3, it says, further resolved, the governor is respectfully requested to report annually to their legislature, indicating the progress being made in implementing these policies and suggested legislation. Is that something he's required to do, or is this just asking him to do?
Just a request.
Just a request. You think he'll do that?
Well, honestly, probably not. No. But
as
a request, just so that there's some.
Sure.
To try and bring it back to their attention, so periodically it's being reviewed. That's the intent then.
You would benefit. I respectfully request that we pass House Concurrent Resolution Number 37 from the committee, as per individual recommendation.
So any objections to passage of HCR 37? Hearing none, move that along. Third bill we have up today is HB 393. Act relating to the operation of state-owned salmon hatcheries. Prime sponsor on this is Representative Bettisworth, and he's out of town, so his aide, Ralph Bennett, will run through this one initially for us. Ralph?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ralph Bennett, and I'm an aide to Representative Bob Bettisworth. I think in your packet there's a memorandum briefly outlining what the current version of HB 393 Fisheries seeks to accomplish. Bob regrets that he couldn't be here today, but bearing that in mind, go ahead and get started. Bob feels, strongly endorses actually, the House Special Committee on Fisheries version of HB 393. He feels that this legislation is especially important in light of our continuing revenue problems and the continued viability of Alaska hatchery operations, both in a domestic and international sense. Basically, this bill seeks to provide a mechanism for transfer of existing FRED hatchery facilities to private nonprofits, and in its current form, the regional associations, with the following stipulations. The potential leasees must be qualified regional associations as set out in current statute. Leasees must comply with existing permit requirements as contained in existing statutes. Leasees shall be required in the lease to operate within the existing stipulations contained in existing statute dealing with egg takes, egg and fry placement, destruction of diseased stocks, sale of eggs and fry, segregation of natural stocks, and several other important criteria. They should be solely responsible for operation and maintenance of those leased facilities. They should indemnify the state from harm or loss and apply on a form provided by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. In Section 2 of the bill, it states that the Department of Fish and Game shall, by lease transfer, move the facilities listed in the proposed new section on page 2. The required transfer is only triggered by a successful application to the department. So are there any questions about this version of the bill or prior versions, I'd be glad to try and answer them for you.
First, Ralph, I don't know if you can answer this one or not at this point. Now, in transferring some of these out of state operation, this should be causing a reduction in the state budget to a certain extent, shouldn't it?
Ultimately.
Why do we have a positive fiscal note?
Well, I have the same question.
There's an analysis on page two, too.
The analysis contained in the fiscal note states that this analysis assumes that all six hatcheries in the committee substitute are transferred to regional aquaculture associations. Since current law requires a private nonprofit hatchery permit to operate a hatchery, the fiscal requirements are based on a transfer through presently established P&P salmon hatchery permitting process. I suppose they mean to imply that their costs for additional permitting activities would essentially cost this amount of money.
Although this doesn't reflect the reduction by not having to operate.
No, it certainly doesn't.
So this kind of, this would give us one half of the one side, not the other. Representative Gall?
Well,
increasing hatchery facilities that currently exist or building new ones has been addressed directly. Perhaps there's someone here from the department that could answer that question for you. I really don't have a succinct answer for you.
No, I don't mean, do you think additional construction is required? I'm advising you that additional construction is required. Where do you project that money will come from?
Additional construction for new hatcheries?
These hatcheries that are named here are not complete. These hatcheries that are named here require extensive amounts of money put into them. The money has to come from somewhere. The answer is it's going to come from the state of Alaska. It's going to come in terms of interest-free loans for a 10-year period. It's going to come from the Department of Transportation. Would you care to confirm or deny or disagree with that?
No, all I could do is speculate. All I can suggest is the traditional avenues, direct appropriation or through the currently available funds that are rolled into loan programs every year by appropriation.
Representative Ewing?
Yeah, just one comment. Let's take the six particular hatcheries. How much is it costing their operating budget to fund the positions in those hatcheries now? I assume the Fred division, is that correct? Is there any figure on how much we're going to save and cost figures?
Representative Ewing, through the chair, I only know that at the present time it costs approximately $370,000 on an annual basis to run hatcheries. I think that's an average, though. That doesn't address individual hatchery costs. It varies widely, I'm sure, because there are varying capacities in these facilities. And there are people here from the department I'm sure could answer those questions.
Ralph, you had a couple of technical amendments that we were going to take a look at. Let's take a run down those so we know what we're doing with those. We've got copies up here to hand out to all of them.
Mr. Chairman, we were looking at the fisheries version right now, correct?
Right. Fisheries CS for HB 393?
Right. There are actually three. On page 2, line 7, we would suggest that you add a new sentence. An application shall include a financial plan approved by the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, Division of Business Loans and Veterans Affairs. Following the period, excuse me.
That would just provide some financial backup for the application, for the applicant to actually prove the ability to take it over and operate it.
Well, essentially, Mr. Chairman, it in a way removes the review of a pro forma from the Department of Fish and Game and moves it into an agency of state government that we feel is more qualified to review these types of data.
Okay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about in the case of an application that would not be approved? Would it still be left, the hatchery be left on the burden of the state financially if in the case that this application was not approved?
In most cases, if the hatchery is a viable entity now and is not slated for closure, and several have been, I assume that it would be. To whatever degree the Department of Fish and Game Division of Fisheries Rehabilitation and Enhancement Division deems it necessary to keep it open with legislative approval.
Prior to the action by the sponsor and the Finance Committee, which of these hatcheries have you been advised by the Department of Fish and Game were slated for closure? And I caution you, prior to this decision to close these hatcheries in the Finance Committee.
Through the chair, Representative Gall, as far as I know, Kloak was a one-time proposed for closure, but that's not the case now.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much. Can you explain to me under what criteria a denial would be appropriate when there are no criteria for the disposal? You say here that if they are denying a disposal, they have to explain why. But there are no criteria for the disposal, so how do we determine why they have denied an application when there are no criteria for accepting the application?
That's in...
I'm so sorry, and the amendment
that's
that was offered.
The second part of the...
Yes, sir. That's
okay.
Correct. The second part Section D, the second two lines, it says that before a certain
date... The amendment fitting into page 2, line 8 there.
That's correct.
Right. Ralph, take a shot at that one.
Should I repeat the question for clarity?
I think I need the question repeated.
Okay.
There are no criteria for disposing of hatcheries. So on what do they base the denial that they have to report on? What will their findings relate to when there are no criteria for the disposal itself?
While there are no criteria for disposal, I think there are numerous places in the normal application process of obtaining a permit to have a site approved or open a hatchery that are already written into current statute, and I assume that denial would be based mainly on those aspects. They've been utilized before in the 20-some-odd applications that have been submitted to the department. I assume there's 20-some-odd. And some of them have been denied. And the grounds are laid out, I think, fairly clearly in existing statute. And I assume that those same criteria would be utilized for denials if they don't meet those criteria.
Might get some more detail on that from the department.
Maybe I could just follow up briefly, if I may, and I don't wish to... believe me, enter into debate on the issue, just that we're speaking of existing hatcheries that were approved for construction by the state of Alaska. So it wouldn't seem that any criteria having to do with the site would be suitable for denying a transfer of that hatchery. Do you have any other ideas about what might be suitable?
Not at this time, no.
Thank you, sir.
Ralph, in the last part of this amendment here, we're adding in Russell Creek Hatchery. The bill was originally designed, everything addresses six hatcheries, but there's only five listed. This is supposed to be the sixth
this
one.
This is the
sixth. Dropped out somewhat along the line.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to Representative Gall's previous question, I believe at one time Russell Creek was also slated for closure, and I'm not up on what the current status of that proposal is.
Thank you.
Further questions, Mr. Bennett? Representative Wesker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe I talked to Representative Betty, he had talked to some of us, not in this particular deal, in regard to fisheries, hatcheries. I wonder if we get Ralph to, if he could explain to us, or at least me, why private enterprise could operate these hatcheries better than the state can, and what the advantages over the output from it as far as the sport fish and commercial fish in regard to who gets these fish. I mean, what problems are we running into here? Could you answer those questions? I gave you too many of them.
Well, through the chair, Representative Liska, I'd like to address the first part of your question. I'd like to respond to that. I think that the latter questions probably should be directed at someone like Dr. Kearns, who's here, that really understands those aspects of the question. I think that Representative Bettisworth feels that there's a demonstrated ability historically on the part of private nonprofits, both the mom and pops and the regional facilities, to take advantage of certain economies that are available that perhaps the state just isn't for whatever reasons, because of their personnel rules and regulations and things of this nature. And the private sector is always able to respond to certain things in the construction area, because they're not subject to appropriation, first of all. Obviously, state hatcheries cannot respond to on a short-term basis. And those are just some of the reasons that we think that they can do a better job.
Well, my basic question is, if we have to subsidize them, why not leave the state in there? That's the biggest question. Because we're going to end up with subsidization. I mean, this is something we're going to have to face one way or the other, whether we have admitted or not.
I haven't kept totally up on this, but I know one of the figures that came out last year when Representative Bezworth was doing a lot of work on Fred's budget was that a couple of the, in investigating, comparing private hatcheries to state hatcheries, the private ones are putting out four times as many fry per dollar as the state was. So apparently they're capable of doing a fairly good job of it. Got a couple of people here to testify. If there's other questions of Mr. Bennett? Not. Thank you, Ralph. Inspector Al may have more. Next person to testify is Kurt Kearns.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Kurt Kearns. I'm an aquaculture specialist from the University of Alaska for the past 6 years. I've been involved in some of the groundwork, the legwork that went into this legislation, and I'd like to quite briefly let this committee know why we are at the point we are now. This was first flagged as a problem in July of 1981 by budget management. Excuse me, Representative Gall, you've already heard this once, but this was flagged as a problem in July of 81 by budget management. No matter what the scenario that is laid out, whether or not state revenues go up, which then, due to the spending limit, require that additional concrete and mortar be poured, and then eventually the O&M costs causing a problem down the pike, or state revenues go down, then you still have a problem. Now, presumably, many of the voters, when they voted for the Fred facilities to be constructed as a bond issue, and I may add that that hatchery construction has been the second most popular item on as far as voter approval, that they intended the facilities to be operated as some sort of economic and biological optimum. A series of Governor Hammond's cabinet had a group that worked on this problem. They appointed a working group. The working group was comprised of budget management people and Regional Aquaculture Association people, Department of Fish and Game people, revenue, and people from Admin. And a list of 30 some odd different options as to how to run, keep these facilities open, keep them running to maximum capacity, be found. And this was sorted down to about a dozen. Those dozen were considerable amount of work was spent on it. The report was given to the cabinet steering committee. The steering committee narrowed it down to five. We went back. Got a couple more AG's opinions, did extensive more work, and found that the only viable option is that of selecting a transfer. This option is not altogether pleasing to the Regional Aquaculture Associations, I know. It has been suggested that somehow the private sector can do things much cheaper than the public sector, and I would, for one, want to wait a considerable amount of time before that come in, because we simply don't have the data, and it's not thought of it's not intended to be any sort of negative comment or negative reflection upon the Department of Fish and Game. The Department of Fish and Game is a vital and integral part of the salmon enhancement program within the state. If we didn't have a healthy Fred division, the overall program would not do as well, and therefore the Alaska salmon industry on into the future would not do nearly as well. This legislation really represents the best option that we've been able to find after 2 years of work.
Representative Gall?
Why didn't you set criteria for hatchery transfer?
When this subject came up, we asked one of the AGs, and he said basically that a lease was the cleanest way. Well, this was an opinion, and then when pressing him further, they felt that he felt that he could not make any statement as far as the constitutionality of a lease, and that each lease would have to be looked at one at a time if you were concerned about the constitutionality. But with a lease, you could do approximately anything that you cared to do. So presumably, when two honorable parties meet, that this will be worked out in such a way that it serves the public interest.
Can I try the same question again?
Sure.
Why have you not set a criteria for selecting the hatcheries to either lease or transfer?
Okay, this criteria, the list of hatcheries that it would be possible to transfer was developed by the Department of Fish and Game. It was based on the criteria of one, having saltwater access, being on saltwater. The independent and the local and regional aquaculture associations, hatchery corporations, have to have cost recovery in order to pay for the fish. On some kind of average, out of 100 fish that are produced, 70 go to the common property fishery, 27 are sold to pay for the O&M and fixed cost, and then 3% are used, 2.5% are used for broodstock. So the criteria was done by the department in some of the initial work, and then additionally, as was pointed out earlier, there is a whole series of hoops that have to that one has to go through before a P&P permit can be given out, including public hearings and a number of other statutory requirements.
Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's such a good idea to dispose of these things or these losers or whatever you want to call them, by whatever criteria you arrive at, why do you select just to give them to regional aquaculture corporations? How come you don't just open it up to the highest bidder or the company that can get together and produce the best results? If you have criteria to get rid of them, you certainly have criteria that they operate under.
Well, okay, one, I don't believe that they're losers. The department spent a great deal of effort and expense going to selecting these sites. Two, the answer to that question, why don't you open up the highest bidder, those of you who were around in the days of fish traps, which of course I wasn't, know the answer to that one, and that is that the fishermen, generally speaking, are quite concerned about their livelihood and want to see their livelihoods remain within the bailiwick of their small endeavors, as opposed to having multinational corporations come in. Multinationals would come in a minute if we threw it open to private profit-making salmon ranching. But this is how I would construct a private profit-making salmon hatchery. I'd find an old barge down in the lower 48. I'd get it outfitted in Seattle Shipyard. I'd tow it up, not stopping in the last porch because there's no need to let your crew get out and hoop it up in town. I'd locate it on the outside island in front of a big rock pile. Hook the water line up, I'd raise the fish, release them. 2 years later, when the first one started coming back, I'd bring a floating barge up and process them right on the spot and head down to Lower 48 again, having never once stopped in Alaskan waters or made any benefit. The entire objective of the Salmon Enhancement Program in the state of Alaska is to convey as many benefits to the citizens of the state of Alaska as possible. And this is why I believe and believe quite strongly that the legislature has chosen wisely when it selected a private nonprofit approach, and as well as the public approach.
I don't know that totally answered the question I asked, but it was a long speech. But I still don't understand how you're proposing that these things just be owned by fishermen, produced for fishermen, and you don't worry about any antitrust violations or anything with respect to any of that, obviously. But you're against having a private company own these, and even if the department set up criteria, like an RFP, you're familiar with an RFP, is why can't you write those restrictive regulations in an RFP and put it out for everybody? Instead of letting it just go to a pre-selected, if you will, amount of people who aren't going to do anything but, if you will, take the state, because they have no incentive to do anything else. as long as they're allowed to get at the, I don't want to say the amount of money we give them, as long as they're willing to, as long as the state's going to continue to assist them, why should they do any different? It's going to have to almost, in order to be palatable, go to somebody who has an incentive to do something, which i.e. is private industry.
Well, I if the question means is why don't you allow private profit-making ventures to come in, that would violate the statutes. If it, if the question is why don't you allow other private nonprofit corporations to come in, I believe the original version of this this bill did have that in there. And I don't think there is a too terrible great objection to that. I think that it is a matter of making sure that the public good is met and providing that the people go through the hoops. I don't think there's a there's an objection to that.
Representative Carl?
Well, I've got so many questions. I'll just try to keep it down to one or two. You say you reviewed these hatcheries. Are you aware that the Cloakini Company, which owns, or corporation which owns the land under the Cloak Hatchery, has not stated any interest at all in having a private nonprofit take it over?
I did not say that I reviewed these hatcheries. I said that the Department of Fish and Game, and by the criteria that they delineated, Cloak would fall under that. I haven't heard of any interest within the private sector to operate that facility.
Do you have those criteria? That's what I asked for before.
No, I can get those to you at a later time, perhaps Mr. Mobley from Director of Preservation.
What is the area of expertise that you'd like to answer questions on? Because there are problems with bonded indebtedness, there are problems with the joint ownership of the state and the private sector, there are problems with the number of fish that will be lost to the fishermen under this transfer, there are problems of who is going to actually be financing these hatcheries. Certainly is not going to be the private sector in the short term. There are problems with the lack of criteria in the bill. There are problems with the regional aquaculture associations expressing no interest in taking these over unless the state, in fact, was going to close them. And that wasn't the result of this legislation. That was a result of the Finance Committee. So where would you like to comment? Because we have quite a broad list of problems.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the ideal situation for the fishermen is for the state to continue to run all of the facilities and build more facilities at no cost to them. That is the ideal situation. That is the best thing that can happen to the fishermen, because they can go in and catch 97% of the fish instead of just being able to catch 70% of the fish. However, 70% of something is superior to 97% of nothing if the facility has to be closed. Last year, whenever this came up before the legislature, and I was asked to contact the regional associations and see what their position was on the matter, and their statement to me, to a regional association of the four ones that are rolling, was that the only condition under which they would choose to run a facility is if it were going to be closed, and the fish and the resources would be lost to their region. Now, subsequent to that time, they perceived, at least two of the corporations have perceived, that by integrating the operation of the Fred facility into their own operations, that they could achieve a certain economy in terms of their operations and the operation of the facility.
Thank you, Dr. Kern.
Thank you, Mr. Kern.
May I make a comment to the chair then in regards to this?
We've got two more people to testify.
Right, and I, believe me, I don't want to do, although it's difficult, is to enter into debate or repartee with the witnesses. But the point that was just brought out here is maybe something to just take note of. First, in the early part of the testimony, it was stated that these are good working hatcheries, and yet at the same time, it is the state's need to dispense with hatcheries that, because of fiscal constraints, that's under discussion. It would seem that since the state has to finance these hatcheries, having transferred them, it might be better off to simply develop criteria for hatcheries which the state should not operate, and then cease to operate them. In that way, the fishermen could still get the maximum number of fish, the state could in fact save money, and the better hatcheries could be retained by the party that is doing a very good job retaining them now. So rather than delay the testimony, I would just make that comment about the previous remarks.
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Perry.
Thank you.
Next, we've got Rick Lauber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Lauber. I'm representing Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and at least in its present form, we would oppose the legislation. The major problem, assuming that the findings are correct, that I have with the legislation, is the fact that it would make only regional aquaculture associations the beneficiaries, if you like, of the grant of these bonded hatcheries in the state of Alaska. I have nowhere here heard anyone discuss the regional aquaculture associations, and I think we just take a brief moment to understand what they are. I have served on the board of directors of two regional aquaculture associations, and I'm somewhat familiar with at least the workings of those two. The majority and the vast majority of the members of the board of directors are commercial fishermen. By statute, they are required to have other user groups present, and they usually do have one person from each one of those user groups, which would be sports fishermen. They usually have one. They have a subsistence fisherman. They have a community representative from a town. They have a processor, and they might have another one or two. But the vast majority of them are the user group from all of the commercial fisheries represented in those regions. I believe that all of the associations also name who the non-commercial fishermen will be on the board of directors. In other words, they select the people that will represent the other user groups. One of them I served on, and maybe both, I can't recall, but one for sure, also had an additional interesting requirement, and that was that anything that passed must have a majority of the fishermen voting for it. That was rather interesting, because that kind of made you a supernumerary on the group, because no matter what you did, your vote couldn't count unless you happened to agree with the majority of the commercial fishermen. So what this legislation would propose to do would be to turn state-financed, state-bonded, if you like, hatcheries that were created through an election of the people, to a small group of fishermen that happen to be the recipients, in most cases, of limited entry permits that are commercial fishermen. Also, a problem that I have, beyond just the appearance of the Regional Aquaculture Association, we have had the first Regional Aquaculture Association was in Prince William Sound, as I recollect, and it's a little bit different than most of the others in that the assessment is a voluntary program. In fact, it was a voluntary program entered into between the fishermen and the processors in the Prince William Sound area that both contributed to the project. They later, of course, availed themselves of funds through the state and have all or many loans and so forth from the state. But we have an experience with the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association that does not leave a very comfortable feeling with the private enterprise, because even though we were, or thought we were, partners in this enterprise, they have now found that it's better to go on their own, so to speak, and sell their fish to whomever they so desire. This last season, we had a situation where they put their fish up for auction, and this is an excellent way of doing it. I wholeheartedly support it. Unfortunately, after the settlement with the Cordova Aquatic Marketing Association, and there was an established price, the minimum price that you could bid for the fish was the price of the CAMA. Now that wouldn't be so bad except for the fact that in the early part of the season, the fish were very small and they were largely males. And the combination of those two made them less attractive. So therefore, they were not available, or it was difficult for the processors to bid on those fish. And in fact, I believe that several loads or several sales were made to foreign processors who did not have the tendering costs and so forth, but could come right up to the hatchery and load the fish. If we were buying fish from fishermen at 23 cents and then we had a 14 or 15 cent per pound tendering cost, you can understand it would be very attractive to a foreign buyer. But they were very interested in selling their fish, and they were not at all interested in selling their fish to those shore-based processors who had been their partners in this project. I suspect that their interest in these hatcheries is to gain a larger share of the stocks of fish, the hatchery stocks, with the combination of their own hatchery and the state hatcheries will over the years become quite large in Prince William Sound, and therefore they will, through their manipulation of the market, control that market. Since the
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Do you think we could have that last remark repeated? Because it's a very interesting point, and I didn't quite catch it. I'm not sure if all the members of the committee
can. Yeah,
we can back up and try and rewrite right.
Through, through a larger share of the number of fish, or a larger share of the market, they would tend to control the market. In other words, they could establish a price. Now, the board of directors, you must understand, are the same people, or at least those that control the board of directors, are the same people that are negotiating fish prices on the open market. Then they can set the price that they will sell or set the arrangement. There's numerous things they could do. They could make a